Unveiling the secrets A-list copywriters use to make themselves and their clients millions. This is the Copywriters Podcast with your host, the world's greatest copywriting coach, David Garfinkel.
What if you found out you were sitting on a pile of money that you didn't even know about? It sounds like the beginning of a new Netflix series, doesn't it? But this happened in real life to our returning champion, agency owner and entrepreneur, Kath Riohorn. She will be the first to admit that numbers are not her. She's a word and people person, not a data ninja. But she developed a conversation with ChatGPT to get it to review her Stripe data, even though, as she also admits, at first, she really didn't have any idea what she was doing. She just knew she needed to do it. And she realized that with minimum effort, like mainly sending out a few emails, she could add 54,000 British pounds, which is about 70,000 US, to her revenues every year. And only with a little more effort than that, she reckoned, she could bring in even more money. Her thought process and how she tackled a clumsy problem with such persistence and humor should be of interest and possibly very valuable to anyone who runs a business and even does a pretty bad job of keeping track of their numbers. You probably remember Kath because of her previous podcast appearance titled Selling Them with Kindness got a lot of engagement and some really heartfelt comments from listeners. Kath's business is called Kind Copy. She lives in Wales in the UK. She is a true family business since it employs herself, her husband, her sister, and two other team members. So now, before we dig into Kath's unusual discovery, let's listen to something that AI would never write. Copy is powerful. You're responsible for how you use what you hear on this podcast, and most of the time, common sense is all you need. But if you make extreme claims, and if you're writing copy for offers in highly regulated industries like health, finance, and business opportunity, you may want to get a legal review after you write and before you start using your copy. My larger clients do this all the time. So, returning champion Kath, welcome back and glad to see you.
Thank you so much for having me back on. This is wonderful.
Yes, so why don't we start at the beginning? I stole your glory by telling about, you know, what you discovered, but how did this all come about? What prompted you to get started to looking at your Stripe records, which to a words and an ideas person sounds like maybe one of the most boring things you could do?
1,000,000%. So let me start this by saying completely allergic to numbers, allergic to spreadsheets, a little bit afraid of my accountant, and wherever possible, try to avoid all of those things, like any reasonable person would, right?
However, well, some would agree. Most of
my accountant, if you're listening to this,
agree. Yeah.
I'm right. Sorry, James. I'm sorry if you listen to this. But when it comes to my business, I had a few beliefs that I completely believed were true. For example, I believed that people no longer followed an ascension model in my market. I didn't believe that you could sell somebody something low ticket and have them ascend to a higher model. I thought for sure that was a different sort of person. And I believed that they thought they needed to feel like they had outgrown us. So one of my beliefs was that we're not ascending people. Another of my beliefs was that people would pay for a subscription, but they didn't tend to move between tiers of service. So how long they stayed with us for, what we could sell them, what we could sell them within a similar sort of price range, for example. So I was carrying quite a lot of assumptions about my business. And
So if I can interrupt.
Yeah.
In other words, you were thinking, if they liked what they were getting from you, that'd be it. They wouldn't want more.
Well, I believe that they wanted more of roughly the same level. So my model is a subscription model anyway. So I also believe that I retained people for a really long period of time. But what I found was, because of blasts or short-term cash grabs or experiments that I had run, people would come in for a shorter period of time. So the lifetime value, for example, was not as high as I thought it was. So I was operating under a number of false beliefs about bumps, upsells, downsells, lifetime value, all kinds of stuff, right? And that was affecting how I was operating in my business. Until I had quite a high-level client who was connected to, let's say, a celebrity. I don't think I can talk about any of those names, but the point of me going to my Stripe data started with, God, this is hard work. I was like, God, every single interaction I'm having is like pulling teeth. I'm spending all day on my phone. I'm spending an outrageous amount of time in comms with this one particular team. And I believed that because that service was my most expensive level of service, I thought that was the best thing to sell because it would be the most profitable thing to sell. So that's where it started. Is that actually true? And when I downloaded my Stripe data and I gave it to the machine, I said, tell me a story about these numbers. Tell me what's actually happening here. Just use words. Don't refer to numbers more than you've got to. Just tell me a story.
So when you say the machine, you mean ChatGPT, right?
I mean ChatGPT. And it was wonderful.
And you didn't have any special kind of profit maximization prompt or filter or you just said, I'm going to dump all this data in your lap. Tell me what you see, right?
That's exactly what happened. My exact prompt, I'll share with you when we put this in the show notes. But my exact prompt was, please help me understand this spreadsheet. Use words where you can, stay away from numbers. Indicate where you're referring to. Talk like I'm a moron. Make it dead easy to understand, like I'm five. And as it started to talk to me and tell me a story about those finances, I suddenly realized that this was much easier to understand. It suddenly felt really human. It suddenly felt much more accessible. And my understanding of what was happening month on month and year on year was suddenly more than just numbers on a spreadsheet. It made sense to me. And that's how I became less afraid of both the numbers and the spreadsheets. So that's how it started. That's how my barrier dropped.
Can you give an example of how it explained it to you that you didn't find intimidating or, you know, eyes glazing over?
Yeah, absolutely. So I can give you guys a step-by-step with screenshots on how you can do this yourself, if any of the listeners would like to do that. But essentially, you download your raw transaction data from Stripe and you give it to ChatGPT and you tell it month on month, tell me a story of what's happening from 1 month to the next. So it would say things like, you came into this year with this much monthly recurring revenue. You had this many people churn and this many people join. And so that meant that you had growth in February. So it told me in words, that might sound stupid. If somebody is more comfortable with numbers, that might not sound like a necessary step in your business, but I found that so valuable.
Oh, I don't know if that sounds stupid. I mean, if the CFO has to speak to the board, that's how the CFO would talk, right?
Yeah. It made it suddenly very accessible.
If a numbers professional had to speak to a civilian, that's how they would talk too.
Mm. So the first thing was that I felt like I had a picture of what was happening month on month, quarter on quarter, year on year. And then I started to dig into it and started to feel like I could ask some good questions. And one of the things that allowed me to do that was this belief that because I had an expensive service, was that actually the thing I should be trying to sell? Because my niece is pregnant, my mother was very ill, and I didn't necessarily want to spend a lot of time handling back and forth communication and managing sort of satellite teams and acting as a CMO necessarily for difficult quote-unquote clients. And then I realized that my most expensive service that felt like a crazy amount of money that I was charging for to me, that worked out at £200 a day. That's not even my hourly rate. So when I saw those numbers and I was thinking, this is taking literally all of my time to manage this one product. I'm like, why am I maxing out with so few clients? And it was because the explanation is that the comms were unclear and the systems and the back end and the process of actually delivering the work. But if I hadn't seen, even though you're charging a lot of money for this service, it actually only works out at £200 a day, I could I would have completely missed that. So in my mind, because that was a more expensive service, that was the thing I should try to sell. But per hour of my time, that is not a profitable service. That's a terrible use of time. And in all fairness, this was the had a client I was working with at the time who was an accountant. And through the research I was doing for him, I started to understand that I should be asking these kinds of questions. So it's only thanks to him that I even knew to ask this.
But so isn't that great, though? That great that as a copywriter, when we get deep into other people's businesses, we learn information that we can use for our own businesses?
Yeah. It was awesome. And he was super smart, switched on guy. He was really young. But I had to consume a lot of his YouTube content. And ordinarily, being a normal human, I would have obviously avoided watching an accountant's YouTube channel. But I learned so much from researching that. So I had an absolute schooling. So then I felt like I could ask even better questions. So profitability per product line, profitability per hour, what can I make once and sell more than once? Because obviously that service is completely bespoke. So how can I productize the stuff that I'm making? And by working back and forth with ChatGPT, I had a conversation that lasted maybe 24 hours. And I had so many insights from that conversation that it has completely changed how I market, sell, promote our business right now.
I'd love to hear about some of the changes you made, but I'd like to ask a question. And when you say a 24-hour conversation, did you mean 24 hours with you back and forth?
Over a 24-hour period. I was dipping back and forth. But I realized that as the conversation was going on...
Oh, so you did it in about one day.
About one day, exactly right. And then as the conversation was going on, I was able to ask better quality questions because I was less afraid.
Yeah, and so I think this is where what you did very well is where a lot of people miss the boat with AI, whether it's writing copy or anything else. They delegate too much of the burden thinking and framing the questions and actually, you know, deciding what direction the conversation's going to go in. They delegate too much of that to the AI. You went ahead and developed informed questions based on a lot of expert knowledge that you had to gather from somebody else, you know, as part of your work assignment. So you weren't exactly the expert, but you were the next best thing. And then you started to dig in. So you never really let loose of the reins. You held on to the reins while you were doing it. I wanted to point that out, both because it's very smart and also because I think, you know, a lot of people have this genie in the bottle idea of AI that, you know, you come to it and say, help me, and it'll figure out what your problem is, how it can almost read your mind. No, it doesn't work that way. It works the way you're using it. I'm sorry, go ahead. I just wanted to point that out.
No, you're completely right. But what's interesting about that is that the quality of the question in the beginning was relatively basic. It was things like, you know, I have a list of questions that I asked it. So one of the things I wanted to know was, it seems like people used to be stickier. It seems like we used to retain people for longer. Is that accurate? That was one of the beliefs that I had. When we looked at the data, it was accurate, but only marginally. Hardly at all, in fact. And on some services, it was much better now than I thought it was. So it started with quite basic questions. And then I suppose the questions broke into three groups of things I was trying to understand. I wanted to understand historical data. Did this used to be like this? Let me think how to word this. So past questions would be things like, were early adopters of our services more sticky, or did we retain them for longer compared with recent buyers? What are some seasonal hotspots, slumps, spikes in revenue throughout the year? Patterns and trends based on historical data. More current questions were things like, what are some of the hidden patterns that exist in our sales data or our retention data that maybe are not obvious to me at first glance? So like right now. And there were future-paced questions, things like, do we have the capacity to scale to X monthly recurring revenue based on the current product suite? And what was great was because ChatGPT has memory, it knows what products and services we offer, and we were able to split our questions into current services and historical products. Like, for example, I didn't think we made any money off products, and we made something like 20 grand last year just off products that were sort of sell my sawdust style services that I had forgotten about doing. I don't even remember bundling them up. So it's really useful even just to get your Stripe data and think, oh my God, I'd forgotten I even sold that. Because as marketers and copywriters, we tend to be able to just sort of pull money out of thin air, and you forget then what works, and you stop doing it, and you try to find a new way to make money. But actually, there's a whole bunch of ways that you've already done this that worked great last time you did them, and you've just forgotten that it worked.
That's really good. So most of your business is service-based, right?
Yes, most of it's service-based, and most of it is also subscription-based, so monthly subscriptions.
And how many different levels of subscriptions do you have?
Well, that's the thing. So I thought, this is now so complicated, I want to make this easier. So what is the one thing I could sell? If I was just to hide everything else on the website, what is the one thing that would bring us the best profit based on the amount of effort that we put in? And I had an idea of what it was based on the most expensive service called Bottomless Brunch. That's between $3,000 and $5,000 a month subscription. But even not $5,000 a month, Monday to Friday, that's still only £200 a day. And obviously, as you can imagine, we cap out, even when I have a full team, a full suite of writers, we cap out at about 8 clients on that membership. So we can't take that many people on. And it's very demanding in terms of my time because I'm essentially their CMO. So that was news to me. And then I have other services that are much, much cheaper, much more accessible, but delivered at scale, group programs and things, that take maybe a day of my month and make really good revenue. And I actually almost closed that service next month in December. I was like, it's boring. The group is quiet. I don't know. I'm just going to chop this service and do something new. That would have been a really stupid move had I not had this data. I was working on, this is boring, we need something new, not does this actually create a lot of revenue based on the amount of effort it takes to fulfill.
Okay, so that's interesting. I think it was our last episode. It's been 2 weeks because Nathan flew off to another country or city or something, and so we had to skip a week. But yeah, we had Angus Fletcher on, a very interesting guy. He's a neuroscientist and a story expert. And he said that people who are, you know, very creative, which includes most of us in this space, will often come up with a lot of new ideas, but they won't have the common sense, his term, to stick with something that's boring, even if the market still wants it. I'm paraphrasing there. And I think this is true of all of us, not just you, but it looks like you caught yourself before you stubbed your own toe.
It was close, though, mind. We were a month away from me axing that program, just because I thought, when I looked at the monthly recurring revenue on Stripe from that service, I was like, well, that's relatively low. Could I replace that revenue easily and gain back a day? Yes, or you could just keep selling the thing that's working, and that has been obviously the much better option.
Could you scale it more, even though you think it's sort of boring?
It's basically infinitely scalable. And I'm currently not running any ads to it. I'm not doing anything in terms of like proactively pushing it. But the thing that excites me most about this is, do you know the realization when you think, my God, I have been so stupid. I'm so bad at this. And a year from now, I can't wait to look back on this time now and think, I thought I was such a big cheese and I've learned so much in the last year. I was so stupid then. I can't wait to see how stupid I'm being now because I feel so excited about, you know, I'm like 7 years into this now. And I thought I had a relatively good idea of how to make some money online. And all of this money was just sitting there. And that almost sounds like a clickbait headline. I found £54,000 in my business. But that data breaks down very specifically, and I'll tell you all about that in a second, but I know Nathan's got a question.
In content marketing and copywriting, the same lesson that you're talking about applies. A lot of our clients say, I'm tired of talking about the same 5 subjects over and over again. We've done 15 episodes on this in the last year. Do we really have to do another episode on this? And when you find what works, keep doing it. We get bored, but we're talking to
a parade, not a standing room. There's always new people in the audience, and they didn't see the message last time. Same thing with ads. When you find an ad that works, keep running it until it doesn't work. We're always so quick. We're creative, and we get bored of our message. We get bored of our offers. But the new people coming into our world, it's brand new to them still. So we need to keep that in mind.
100%.
Yeah. Good lesson that we have to keep learning, because we're always fascinated with that new rabbit hole we can go down. Yeah. I completely forgot. What were you going to talk about next?
So what I was going to say was, I found £54,000 in my business sounds like a clickbait headline. And I'm conscious that to an audience of copywriters, that sounds inflated and it sounds like an insane projection, right? So I want to quantify that. Currently, so one of the beliefs I had, people don't ascend. So when I worked with ChatGPT, I asked some questions to figure out if that was true. 14% of my audience automatically just buys something more expensive. But I have no system.
Buys another subscription product that's more expensive.
A different subscription or service and spends more money the second time. The belief that I had was that they don't ascend. The truth is that I have no systems, literally zero systems, maximum chaos. There is nothing in place. I was telling myself I'm not a systems thinker, but the reality was I just hadn't built any of the systems because I didn't have this insight that I needed a system in this place. So it was just max chaos. When it came up, I would make an offer. Lots of the time, they would take me up on it. Some of the time, they would come to me and ask to buy something more expensive. If I can get that number from 14%, which is 1 in 7 people, to 20% that's the industry standard. That's not me inflating a random number. I looked it up. Apparently 20% is the average what we should expect in our industry. That will translate to £54,000 based on the upsells that already exist in the business. And the way I'm going to do that is by literally building one email sequence, which is currently in place, that at the 30-day mark, when they've been with me for this one service, I'm going to offer them something else. And that's the entire plan. And if that works, I'll start building out upsells and bumps for everything else. But right now, I'm just doing one to see, because I'm dabbling with systems, David. I'm dipping my toe in the water of systems. I feel so excited by that, because the thought that I can build one email sequence that keeps working all the time and keeps getting us paid, like, you kind of know that you can do it because you do it in other people's businesses. But when you do it in your own business, it feels completely different. And you're like, how could I have been so foolish? Because I solve this problem for other people and I make this recommendation all the time. Why did I never sit and look at my own data like this with emotional detachment, with, you know, spot the leak mentality and find the bottleneck, spot the leak. And so I just wasn't doing it.
I'm going to push back a little bit against your own self-criticism. I think sometimes you need to have the products or the subscriptions in place, and you need some proof that people are going to buy them. And maybe you took a little too long to get that proof, but you need to take some time to get that proof if you're not a scam artist. If you want to make sure what you got is good before you really start to scale up. The other thing I'd like to say, and this is just a hunch, I don't know your business very well, just what we've talked about on these calls basically, is you say there's all this chaos. Maybe you shouldn't eliminate that entirely. Maybe that's part of your operating style.
I'm saying, sure,
put the email sequences in, find better ways to upsell, but wouldn't try and make it too military, cut and dry, hermetically sealed clean room. You know, might not be comfortable.
I don't think I'd even be able to if I wanted to, but just a tiny little bit of structure. Like, for example, you know, putting in a survey at the point where they join to ask them what nearly stopped you. I've built out whole email sequences just from their language. And I know that this is the thing that we tell ourselves that we should do as copywriters and we put in place in other people's businesses. But when my offer suite was so scattered, it was quite hard to do that. So it was happening on kind of an ad hoc basis, but I had no central place for it. Honestly, I feel like the cleverest person I know right now, because I'm so pleased that I managed to set up an automation. Isn't it funny how you can do all these creative things and you think, that's just what I do. And you connect two pieces of software together and you're like, yes. totally different skill set. So it feels really impressive.
So maybe the clickbait headline I should use to promote this podcast is copywriter uses the same techniques that she uses with her clients on her own business, and to her astonishment, finds out they actually work.
Yeah, possibly. The excitement for me is, so one of the exciting things was you can have a leveraged service which is really profitable, and with one system, even just one, you can find a bunch of money in your business. But one of the things that's really exciting about this is that you can then have a really clean acquisition channel. So this could become a webinar into that group. So it becomes much more education-based, and then you've got an acquisition channel, and then you've got one thing that you run ads to, and it all just feels like a very clean funnel. Ultimately, the problem that I was trying to solve, and I feel like I'm always trying to solve in my business, is that this all feels a bit messy. And the one clear path in to buy, make it easy, get a quick win, and then sell them something else feels like a, you know, feels like I'm seeing through the matrix a little bit at the moment.
Yeah, and yet it's even worth hanging out in that chaos if it is working, because, you know, triers are triers and looky-loos are looky-loos and buyers are buyers. And once they bought one thing from you, as you are now rediscovering, they'll buy something else.
Mm. Well, one of the things I wish I could do that I'm a little bit scared to do is I wish I could do the same trick that I did with the Stripe data with my bank data. So it would be, so I could see where the spending is happening, where the expenses, where the allocation is happening. I'm a little bit nervous to do that. I don't necessarily want to upload bank information into ChatGPT, but for now, even just having revenue in, even if that's all I get, that's way more insight than I had before.
How about if you ask ChatGPT to design an Excel spreadsheet for you with the formulas, but never and tell it exactly what you want it to do, and then you just upload that into Excel so it never goes on the web?
Mm-hmm. That doesn't avoid the problem of I'm allergic to spreadsheets. So if we can find a solution that doesn't involve spreadsheets at all, that'd be great.
Maybe an accountant?
Yes, I do have an accountant. Like, part of the issue for me was when I would speak to my accountant, he had a really clear idea of what was going on. And I feel like I've got a really well-established business that makes plenty of money. And I felt, honestly, quite embarrassed at my grasp of our numbers. I felt a little bit ashamed of the success we'd had. Not ashamed of the success, but ashamed of my ability to manage and predict where that revenue was coming from, just because I didn't really interact with my numbers at all. I was still quite afraid of them. So
how do you think he felt about his ability to write copy?
Well, I tell you what, I'll write the copy for him. He does the numbers for me. We got a fantastic relationship. Lots of the time, I didn't even know what tab he was on. I didn't even know there were tabs in Excel. So lots of the time, I was even on the wrong page. So I think I was a lost cause for him. But this really helped me. This version of, like, take each year and tell me the story. So if anybody is listening to this as a writer, as a wordsmith, and you think, I'm a little bit intimidated by the numbers, and you do nothing else at all, if you don't try to interact or interpret the data at all you want is for it to tell you the story of the money in your business, this is a really reassuring jumping-off point that tell me the story around what's happening month to month, and that will give you a lot more confidence about what you're coming in with, what you've got to play with, what's recurring, where your hotspots and choke points are throughout the year. That was a useful one for me, because for our market, we work a lot in the fitness space, and we see November be quite good, September be quite good, December's really quiet, January's sometimes amazing, sometimes awful, depending on the niche. Summer's generally quite poor. So if you can normalize those undulations of finances and you think, well, I'm expecting to come into a quiet period. Like, one of the things I learned from this is in Q4, my audience loves to buy products and they don't love to buy subscriptions. That's based on 5 years of data that was just sitting there, and I didn't even know to look for it.
I mean, it makes sense, right? You know, I mean, who wants to read a textbook on Christmas, right?
I guess, yeah. But it was was so useful for me to see that laid out in a non-emotional. Do you know when people say, if a CEO came into your business, what would be the first thing they would change? If you weren't running it like and somebody who was emotionally attached to it. This mm-hmm. was the first time I felt like I was able to think about my business without an emotional connection to the words and being in love with the process of writing. And I don't want to lose that, but to have a little bit of distance about, put a product in here, like push your sales calendar towards this thing at this time of year. That was the sort of thing that I was never able to do on like an annual scale until now. And I think it's going to really change how we go into next year and how we plan out our year.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of, you know, sort of zooming out, I think this is one of the most interesting and clever uses, you know, innovative uses of AI I've heard, because AI does bridge the numbers world and the language world. I mean, we can nitpick about how well it writes stories or comes up with new ideas, and I have plenty of things to say about that, but that's not important here. So this is great. Nathan, what are your final thoughts?
I love this because it's thinking outside of the box, and as copywriters, we tend to look at these large language models from a very narrow point of view. We think, how can this help me write better copy? How can this help me plan out better campaigns? But I love that this is the second time that Kath has come on and had something completely revolutionary that just blew my mind the whole episode. So I totally dug this week's episode.
Thank you, man.
Me too.
Kath, before we're out of here, is there any place that you would like to send people where they can find out more about what you're doing, connect with you, anything like that?
I think perhaps one of the things that could be really useful for people is for them to see the list of questions I asked ChatGPT. So I'll link to an article I wrote in my Substack that's got some screenshots, a walkthrough, a list of questions. You know, take your pick, swipe any of them that you think would be useful. And if you like what I write about on there and you'd like to give me a follow, that would be cool.
Perfect. And we will make sure to link that in the show notes over at copywriterspodcast.com. We'll also link your website and your Instagram there so people can follow you there as well. And if you enjoyed this episode and you want more like it, head on over to copywriterspodcast.com. Until next time, we will catch you later.
Catch you later. And thanks, Kath.
Thank you.
Stop using the hero's journey in your sales copy. My book, The Persuasion Story Code, will help you put together stories that convince your prospects and resolve their objections. If you are a copywriter, you'll appreciate that every single one of the 25 kinds of stories in this book have been proven time and time again in profitable sales copy. But I've also used these kinds of stories to close 5- and 6-figure deals for my own business, and so have many of my clients. These stories are easy to create and easy to tell. They sound like ordinary conversation, but they are all designed and proven to lead to a yes. You can get the Persuasion Story Code on Amazon.com. So get your copy today.